Jeff Merrick, you and I, sir, will once again be voices in the wilderness on this. Maybe not. I don't know.
I don't think so. Here's the thing.
There needs to be some line of separation between what John Scott did and who John Scott is. And that's my issue right now, is that you can find what John Scott did to Louis Erickson as something that is indefensible, but I find John Scott himself to be eminently defensible as a player. If you're gonna blame anybody, you don't blame the guy doing his job. You blame the people who put him in that job, Jeff Merrick.
I'll even take it one more level above and ask this question. Given that there is no history for John Scott of this type of behavior, and you may not like John Scott, many of you don't. You may not like fights, some of you don't. You may not like stage fights. You may not like, you know, the obvious, you know, as some call them, dancing bear fights. You may not like all that, and I understand that, and that's fine. That's your own thing. But one thing we are all on the same page about is that there is no prior history of this type of behavior for John Scott. Okay? Let's not bring who John Scott is into the argument about what happened last night with Louis Erickson. Because under the terms of the CBA, this may sound horrible to some people, but brace yourselves, folks. John Scott has the same rights as Sidney Crosby. There are no priors. And by the standard that's already been set right now, I didn't like the hit, right? I didn't like it at all, but I'm not one of those. You got to throw 40 games at him. You got to throw 30 games. You got to make an example of John Scott. And Brendan Shanahan needs to show the NHL that this will not be tolerated. No, you can't do that. The standard now is how many games, Wish? Five games.
We'll get to that in a second or two. But here's your point is really well taken, because I think one of the problems, I had a lot of problems, obviously, with the reaction to this hit. And one of them was this amazingly daft idea that there should be some meritocracy of player safety in the National Hockey League. Okay, you want that? Here's what you get. You get no severe punishment for Shea Weber for banging Henrik Zetterberg's head against the glass because he's Shea Weber. If you really want this to be based on the importance of the player that's taken out, and Sean Gentile from the Sporting News has a good piece that's like eight improvements you can make to the supplemental discipline thing. One of his ideas is asinine, though, which is you take a player from your own team and he's out as long as the player who's injured is out. So it's a comparative eye for an eye thing. Listen, if you really want it to be a thing where the person you injure and that person's value, his talent, his skill set, which is something I heard a lot of in the last 24 hours about John Scott. He doesn't have a skill set. The guy he hit has a skill set. If you really want it to be about that, guess what? Every time your guy does something stupid to a goaltender, that's 20 games. If Andrew Shaw runs into Mike Smith and Mike Smith gets injured, he's on his ass for 20 games. Because I don't care if you're Sidney Crosby, you're not as important as a goalie. So if you really want to do food chain of stuff in this league as far as who gets hit and who doesn't, yeah, if you hurt a goalie, it's 20 games. You really want that?
Here's a problem, too. Considering the nature of this hit, and we've seen a lot of players make hits like this. This was all started with Mike Richards and David Booth. It went to another level with Matt Cook and Mark Savard. But, I mean, how many Shane Doans, how many Dustin Browns have we seen make this identical hit? And if you give John Scott 20 games, pick another player, a star player, a franchise type player who will make this hit, you've already set the standard at 20 games. You're going to give Shane Doan 20 games for that hit?
Here's three issues with the John Scott thing from last night. Okay, first of all, if you are somebody who is saying that he is now has the reputation of going after star players because of what happened between John Scott and Phil Kessel in the preseason, then you are revising history in order to make a point that you know is a fallacy. It is bullshit. We all know what happened. There was a fight. Scott was put out there by Ron Ralston to beat up a Maple Leaf. Randy Carlyle decided that Maple Leaf was going to be Phil Kessel in a feeble attempt to try to to put water on the burning fuse that was John Scott on the ice. And guess what Scott did? He said, "I'm coming after you." And he did. You cannot say that all of a sudden he is John Scott, headhunter of the stars, based on that situation with Kessel. That was a very unique situation. Come on.
I don't want to blur the lines here about the previous discussion as to not allowing how you feel about John Scott to influence what should go into a suspension. Because right away, and this is one of the, Maddie and I were talking about this before the show. Last night, Twitter was insufferable, right? Because most people on Twitter, and I get it, because you only have 140 characters to milk with, but you want to make it a black or white issue, but it is not a black or white issue. This is a muddy lake. This is not an azure sky of deep summer. It is not that. There is a lot of gray area involved in this discussion. So Twitter's a place where you can make things really, really simple, right? But you can't tell me for one second that John Scott, the two minute a night guy, the guy that's just there to fight, deserves less rights than someone else who doesn't have any priors. Just because what? He scared Phil Kessel.
And because he serves a role. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's like people have called him garbage. People have called him not a hockey player. He serves a role. He's an intimidator. It clearly doesn't mean he's a headhunter, because this is going to be his first suspension, but he's there to scare people, and that's his role. And now we get into why John Scott exists. That was one of the teasers, and Jesse Spector, of course. Jesse Spector had a very good line, which, of course, why does John Scott exist? Because his parents had unprotected sex, which is very true. Why does John Scott exist, Jeff Merrick? I'll give you two reasons why he exists. He exists because when Milan Lucic ran over Ryan Miller like an effing freight train, the entire hockey world rose up their arms and said, "What a bunch of cowards these limp-wristed wimps that the Buffalo Sabres are, that the big bad Boston Bruins not only beat them up, but psychologically damaged them for the rest of the season." Remember that, Merrick?
Yep.
It wasn't just that they beat them up. It was that they psychologically damaged them. Okay? So now what did the Sabres do? They muscled up. And at the time, everybody said, "Whoopee! Thank God! They muscled up. They got some grit. They're going to take on those big bad Bruins." So it's very much Joker Batman-esque. I made you, you made me.
Mm-hmm.
John Scott would not be a Buffalo Sabre were it not for Milan Lucic, and Louis Erickson would not have a concussion were it not for John Scott.
Thich Nhat Hanh, this is because that is. Like, the Boston Bruins have created around them a culture of intimidation, a culture of toughness, a certain breed of violence. So should it come as any surprise when a team rises up and tries to, play as dangerous as they do, or try to go dirt versus dirt against the Boston Bruins? Now, the difference is the Boston Bruins have a lot of players that can also play. They have big, scary men who can also play the game. Lucic, Adam McQuaid, Zdeno Chara. They have large, strong, and skilled hockey players on their team. Not everybody has that luxury. So if you're going to muscle up against the Boston Bruins, there are only so many Milan Lucic's to go around. Ditto for Adam McQuaid, to say nothing of Zdeno Chara, where he is one of a kind. Boston has a monopoly on these types of players. So should we even begin to feign surprise where a team would have the nerve to try to muscle up against them?
No.
No. And again, I'm not saying the hit was good. It wasn't a good hit. I think he should be suspended for it, but five games.
But
if you're going to be consistent with what you've seen with whether it's LaPierre, whether it's McLeod, whether it's most recently Ryan Garbutt, I'm sorry, folks, this is a five-game suspension.
But let's go back to the question at hand. Why does John Scott exist? This isn't rec league. John Scott didn't go to the rink last night and put his name on a clipboard and was placed on his local beer league team for a 10 o'clock game. He was hired by the Buffalo Sabres. He was put in the lineup by the coach of the Buffalo Sabres. Mike Milbury, for all of his hyperbole last night in saying Ron Ralston should be fired. Oh, and by the way, was Ron Ralston in over his head last season when he put the Sabres back within sniffing distance of the playoffs during a sell-off, during a time when guys were being shipped out like Darcy Regier was running eBay? Was he over his head then? Because now it evidently is over his head, being that the team is terrible and they're in a complete rebuild. So that's a side note. Ron Ralston put him in the lineup. Darcy Regier hired him.
That's bigger. And that's bigger, by the way.
That is bigger, but let's go back to Ralston for a second. Do you remember, again, maybe I'm the only one with an effing memory in this world. Do you remember when Ron Ralston was fined by the National Hockey League for player selection or player usage during the Kessel thing?
Because he left John Scott on the ice.
Right. Remember how everyone went crazy about that and said, what's wrong with this league? How could you go and fine a guy for doing that? Now we're going to start fining guys for picking the guys who are on the ice, blah, blah, blah. What did we hear last night? How could Ron Ralston put John Scott on the ice with a 2-goal deficit in the third period? How dare he? Okay, so at the Kessel thing, the league's a bunch of assholes, but now we're telling Ron Ralston who he should play. Got it. Now, the Darcy Regier thing is, like you said, a different issue, and that's why I proffer this. That's why I propose this, because I think it's time. We've fined players. We've suspended players. We've suspended players for an F-load of games, and nothing's worked. We have to deal with this bullshit every night. And Merrick and I, quite frankly, are sick of talking about it. We'd love to talk about other things, but this shit keeps happening. So here's a way to make this shit stop happening. Maybe it's time to levy massive fines on coaches who play these guys and the general managers who hire these guys for their teams. And don't internally punish these guys like a team can and should do, and allows the league to play mommy and bad cop. That's the real issue right now. And I'll go one step further. Do agents have to get licensed by the National Hockey League to practice within hockey?
By the Players Association.
By the Players Association. Cut. How about this? How about we do a deal with the NHLPA? Because the NHLPA obviously should be in favor of anything that helps out player safety. We do a deal in which agents of these guys take a financial hit when they're suspended. Wouldn't that be interesting? What if we made coaches, GMs, and agents, a.k.a. the enablers of these players. They are all the enablers of these players, Jeff Barrick. What if we took all of them and made them as responsible for that player's actions as the player himself?
I wonder
if that would change behavior quicker than Brendan Shanahan making a guy sit for 5 regular season games.
Couple of things. One, about the agents question. I've always wanted to ask, and we see this plenty, countless times on Twitter, mainly it's when one of their clients gets hurt. Agents decrying, player safety and the NHL needs to be more proactive about it and get 30 hits out of the game. I've always wanted to ask, would you drop a client who deliberately hurt or concussed another player? Would you drop him as a client?
And?
What do you think the answer would be? What do you think? It's one thing to bitch at something that stares you in the face, and it's another to actually do something about it. To the second point about the dynamic between the coach and the general manager, I'll lay more, if you want to get rid of these types of situations, I'll lay more at the feet of the general manager, because the dynamic between the coach and the general manager is a political one. And let's use the obvious example that we're talking about now, John Scott, Darcy Regier, and Ron Ralston. Darcy Regier procures the services of John Scott for the reasons you just laid out, Greg, because of the Boston Bruins. Because the Boston Bruins came in, beat them up, and took their lunch money. And so they needed someone to come in to equalize and try to nullify the effects of these big, bad, Sean Thorntons and Milan Lucic's of the world that were running over the goaltender. So, if you're Ron Ralston and you choose not to play John Scott against the Boston Bruins, a player that your general manager put on your team specifically to play against the Boston Bruins, and as a head coach, you do nothing, and you don't play him. Are you acting in the best interest of your job? No, not at all. Let's go even one step further. How was last night marketed from the NHL's point of view?
Why, I believe, Jeff Merrick, it was marketed as Wednesday night rivalry night.
But what were all the visuals around it?
Milan Lucic running over Ryan Miller because Miller is a hippie and Lucic is a man.
It was the bloody history between these two teams. Yeah. Now, it was the 1970s with, Schoenfeld fighting and going through the Zamboni doors. it was, you know, the murderer's row that was the Boston Bruins from O'Reilly to Wensink to Jonathan. It was, you know, Rob Ray and Larry Playfair. Like, the whole way this entire game was marketed was all about the violent history between the two. Now, I'm not saying that justifies what John Scott did. I think it was, again, on the record, bad hit, deserves suspension. 5 games is it for me. That's what I think. But at every single level, I mean, this game and this quote-unquote rivalry, which was on display yesterday, was all built around this blood feud and the legitimate hockey hatred between these two teams with a lot of violent slash questionable behavior that was used as a marketing tool by the National Hockey League.
To go back to your earlier point, the Boston Bruins are a reason why this happens. And you know, I don't fault Milbury in the moment to not recognize that, but I mean, that man sees the world through black and gold, and it's interesting to me that despite all of that, didn't at least acknowledge why John Scott exists. And I, to that, sir, I will use an Alfred Pennyworth quote from The Dark Knight. If only I could do a quality Michael Caine impression, I cannot, so I will simply read it. You crossed the line first, sir. You squeezed them. You hammered them to the point of desperation. And in their desperation, they turned to a man they didn't fully understand. Maybe they didn't fully understand that John Scott had this in him, but now they know. And they know exactly why he's on the roster, because the Bruins put him there.
You know, at the end of it, too, John Scott in that situation isn't talented enough to make a good hit on that play.
Does he belong in the league is the question. Because I obviously we both saw a lot of that last night. Does he belong in the league?
The way the game is played now under the current NHL rulebook, yes, he does. There is still a role for that player on that team. Absolutely.
I think, again, I come back to this all the time when we start talking. I reacted a little violently last night on Twitter because I felt like, once again, the same people were using this as a pivot to the anti-fighting thing.
Because
John Scott evidently is the flag bearer for fighting, even though the guy fights me like once every 3 months now because no one wants to fight him.
Dude, the light went on and the moth showed up. That's why I stayed off Twitter last night. I'm like, oh, light's on. Here come the moths. Here's another question. Here's a follow-up question to the day. Tell me one new thing in the debate. Just tell me one. Just one new observation. Because last night Twitter was all of the same people making the exact same points.
I'll tell you the new thing. evidently, when you get down by 2 goals in the third period and your team looks completely apathetic, you don't put out your enforcer to try to spark a fight or do something crazy to get them going. Like, you don't do that now. Like, you used to do that all the time. Like, that was just something that was accepted, that your quote, here comes, ready? Here's the air quotes. Your energy line comes out. Yeah. Your energy line comes out to try to turn the game and shift the paradigm and get your guys out of a funk.
It's called a hit shift. Well, you're out there for 45 seconds to hit everything in sight.
Right. But the problem is that for a Boston fan, the energy line is okay because Sean Thornton can play hockey better than John Scott, right? So that's why it's okay that the Bruins' energy line gets to come out when they're down and they need a boost. But John Scott can't come out because he's a pylon.
See, here's the tricky thing. If you get rid of the John Scotts of the world, it's not as if intimidation is going to leave this game. Like, this idea, we see this all the time. Oh, you got to, you know, needs to be more respect. You got to get the John Scotts out of the game. Are you crazy? All that does is that just, instead of John Scott being the king of the jungle, it's Milan Lucic. That's it. And intimidation still stays in the game. It is not going anywhere in this game. It's not. Intimidation is not leaving this game.
Listen, much like fighting, this John Scott thing allowed Jeff and I to take the steam out. The air is out of the balloon. We can focus on more jovial things and whimsical things. Chris Osgood is going to join us, so we'll revisit fighting then, but it's goalie fighting, so it's different and better. We have to deal with two more pieces of supplemental discipline housekeeping after we start the program. Uh-huh. But then we are going to talk about hockey because we do have to discuss, and maybe we'll discuss this with Ozzy, the fact that the Ottawa Senators proved Daniel Alfredson wrong. He obviously made the wrong choice. We all know that the Red Wings are an inferior team to the Senators, and we can start shining up Lord Stanley's chalice for Paul McLean's boys. With that, let's start the show proper, shall we?
He's Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Don't you give the guy a little bit of rope this year?
No.
Give him no rope. No rope.
I want to see the guy that flops. He's, you know, the Faith No More video. That's the guy you want to see.
Are you kidding? Babcock's going to Bilesma this sucker.
Oh, yes. My Dick Tracy like good looks. Yes.
The Gentleman's Parlor.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I don't know if you know, but the Atlantic Division has been renamed as the Metropolitan Division. You have any thoughts about that?
Is it really?
Yeah.
He's a top-line player for the Carolina Hurricanes, and I still think of his schwanz when I hear that name. I don't want to take a shit on the Devils. Rangers fans do that every day for me.
Debate Hockey.
Can someone please break it to Phil? He's very sensitive. They always boo him in Boston.
This high-sticking review brought to you by...
Well, listen, we're having
Cialis.
A debate.
Cialis. There it is.
We're having a
brought
debate.
Brought to you by Hernan Pills. This high-sticking...
We're having a debate, and this dissension is sponsored by Doritos.
Pop culture.
He's wound so tight, all right? Like Cameron Fry, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Lump of Coal, the Diamond. If he's wound that tight on the day of an exhibition game, probably not a good time to be wound.
Not a good time to be
wound. Not a good time to be wound.
No.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
All right, a couple things. First off, question of the day. Make one change to NHL supplemental discipline. Anything you want to change, just make one suggestion on how you change it. PuckDaddyBlog@Yahoo.com, @Wyshynski, @JeffMerrick on Twitter, #MVSW. What's that?
Here's one from an anonymous pro hockey player whose name I cannot reveal.
So wait a second. An actual pro hockey player.
Yeah, who actually signed it anonymous, which is quite funny.
but I know the...
you know who it is.
Full disclosure, pulling back the radio curtain, I know who this is. And in case you were wondering, it is not the player.
No, not from Puck Daddy. That was Sidney Crosby. We know that.
Merrick.
Oh, that's right. Don't allow a player to practice or travel with the team during suspension. Players don't seem to be affected by missing games or money. So I guess remove them completely from away from the team.
It's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
Here's Sean's Gentile's rundown from Sporting News. Okay. More organizational fines, coach penalties, roster cap penalties, which is a sticky wicket, but not a bad
idea.
What's
this one?
Roster or cap penalties.
So, okay, because I saw this yesterday on Twitter as well. One idea that came from, can't remember, Dave something on Twitter I read last. Anyway, said all the fines should count against the team's cap the following season.
That's creative.
So if you're out, you know, $200,000, it's $200,000 off your team's cap the next year.
That's not a bad idea. I wonder how that would affect salary floor for some teams.
Yeah. Although, you know, can't you just look at suspensions? Because, look, we've talked about this before. The NHL expects players to play right up to that line and stay there. But you have to understand that there's going to be spillover over that line. It's going to happen. Like, aren't suspensions just a cost of doing business?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yep, really?
Totally.
You're never going to, quote-unquote, clean up this game. It's not a game that can get clean. Sorry, this one's dirty for life.
Draft pick docking, not really keen on that. Piggybacking suspensions. This is sort of the if Coletta comes back and earns a 5-gamer, his next suspension will be 15. That's an interesting one. So real quick on the Department of Player Safety, I spoke with Brendan Shanahan this week in New York, specifically to ask him about our conspiracy theory that all of these suspensions are 5 games, so they don't trigger the 6-game appeal thing is in the CBA, and they deny it.
Really? That's shocking. Deny that there's something untoward. Okay, but we'll just wait. So this will be our 6th in-person hearing now with John Scott.
Uh-huh.
And the trigger is 6 games.
Yeah.
This is the 6th in-person hearing. Uh-huh. And watch, he's going to get a 5-gamer for this. But it's another in-person.
Oh, okay. Shanahan says that it's because they want he says he likes the appeals option. He likes the idea of potentially there being some sort of a third-party validation for what they do. But the thing that they haven't figured out yet, and I kind of find this fascinating, let's not say like Coletta, but let's just say Player X gets 10 games from the Department of Player Safety.
Right.
Bettman upholds it, as he just did with Coletta, by the way. Bettman upholds 10 games. Then that player goes to the neutral arbitrator, and the neutral arbitrator knocks the suspension down to 5. Now, player gets 5 games worth of money back, maybe if he hasn't served – the full length of the suspension, he gets to come back and play again. How does the Department of Player Safety process that suspension now? Do they see it as the 10 games that they believe he deserved? or do they see it as the five games that the non-hockey neutral arbitrator decided to knock it down to?
It should be.
Shanahan didn't have an answer for this yet, by the way. It hasn't happened yet. But I found it interesting as far as because precedent plays such a large role in this entire process. What would that be? Would that be a guy who's got a 10 on his record or a guy who has a 5 on his record?
It's got to be a 5 because it's part of the CBA. It is an agreed upon issue within the collective bargaining agreement. They have both agreed to respect what the independent arbitrator says, so it should be, by your example, a 5 game and not be considered a 10 in the eyes of the Department of Player Safety.
I'm not a lawyer, obviously. If you read my lockout coverage, you know that.
Or an actuary.
Or an actuary. But I do wonder if any of the lawyers out there that may know a thing or two about criminal law, if you have a 30-year sentence, right, and then you get parole after 7 for, like, good behavior.
Now, this is different. This isn't parole. This is on appeal. This is like a whole new trial, and that number gets reduced from 30 to 20.
Okay, so it's not parole. It'd be an appeal thing.
Yeah.
Okay. I still think they should look at the 10, to be honest with you.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
I do. No. Because it's been agreed upon that they will respect the ruling of the third-party arbitrator. If you're going to respect that ruling, then it has to be a 5.
I see the arbitrator as a way for guys to get money back. I see them as a way to get some games back so they can play again. But here's the thing, right? Like, I think as fans, we have decided to put our faith in this process and this system and hope that these guys can be consistent and hope that they're trying to build towards something proactive and positive for this league. An independent neutral arbitrator doesn't have the same aim. They're merely looking at this case and evaluating this case based on all the available information, yada, yada, yada. They don't look at Coletta, let's say, and think, well, this guy is a scumbag. He's been penalized 6 times in 4 years.
Isn't that what the justice system should do?
But they're not going to see it the same way as
you know, that's the idea of why you don't have tainted jury members.
Well, I get that, but you see, this is again, you know, trying to compare hockey to real life. Like, hockey is much more about being Judge Dredd than it is about the actual legal system. It's about
you brought up the legal system example, not me.
It's about Brendan Shanahan wearing the face shield and being judge, jury, and executioner, isn't it? By the way, Victor Fath has an amazing Judge Dredd mask.
Yes,
now.
That is
really
true.
Check out.
That
really
is
really
cool.
Ryan Garbutt, a player that no one knew before this week, gets 5 games. And this is one, sir, where, you know, again, we don't want to be tinfoil hat boys here.
Was there an in-person hearing on that, by the way?
There was.
Oh,
an in-person hearing, but an in-person hearing where Jim Neal was in the room. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to go conspiracy theory on top of conspiracy theory, it's 5 games instead of 6 games, and Shanahan gave a break to an old Red Wings friend.
That's going to happen anyway if you have any type of hockey person in that position. Right? When it was Coley Campbell, if there's any, like, you know, old Rangers in the room, all of a sudden he's being, or all Vancouver Canucks in the room, he's being sympathetic towards his old crew.
Of course. Finally, like we mentioned before, Pat Coletta's 10-game suspension upheld by Gary Bettman. If you go to Puck Daddy now, you can read the whole shebang, the entire ruling from Bettman on Coletta. It's actually a pretty good read as far as legal documents go. Well laid out. And as you pointed out, Merrick, Gary's not really trying to leave any wiggle room for his friends in the PA.
Oh, it's awesome. Page 2, first paragraph. Shanahan in-person supplemental discipline hearing in New York. Later that day, oh, I love this, Mr. Shanahan announced that Mr. Coletta would be suspended for 10 games for an illegal check to the head of Mr. Johnson. Here's the great line. The union raised no objections, procedural or otherwise, with the conduct of the disciplinary hearing itself, which all parties, including Mr. Coletta, were provided a full and fair opportunity to be heard. Translation, we better not hear an effing appeal on this one. You raised no stink about it. Otherwise, why is that line in there? The exactly. Union raised no objections, procedural or otherwise. Love it. Honestly, man. I know Gary. I like Gary Bettman. I really do. And this is another reason why I really like Gary Bettman, because that is a direct F you to the union.
There is a certain Claude Lemieux aspect of you want him on your side.
Oh, totally. Oh, he's dude, he's the smartest guy in the room. Say what you want about Gary. We've made the point before. He's the smartest guy in the room.
And if he isn't, he still thinks he is. Pierre Smith writes in about the QOD, how to improve the department player safety. Apart from taking punishments to the extreme, 20 games plus massive fines to players, coaches, GM, teams, etc., publicly shame the guilty party. The players, the coaches, and organization need to make a public apology, educate them that about what they are doing to the other guy, how a concussion will permanently affect someone, so on and so on. Finally, make offenders go on an anger management therapy.
Oh, Sean Avery.
Yeah, but honestly, dude, like, I kind of wonder why that isn't part of this. Like,
because it hasn't been collectively bargained, that's why.
But why hasn't it been? Like, Matt Cook had a lot of demons going on, right? He had a lot of personal issues that went beyond hockey. But there's no question that his time in therapy and dealing with those issues hasn't had him come back and be a different kind of guy and a different kind of player, outside of obviously trying to cut Erik Karlsson's leg off, according to Eugene Melnyk.
How's that forensic investigation going, by the way?
So why isn't why wasn't anger management or anything of that nature bargain into this thing if you had a suspension of like 5 games or more, or if you're a repeat offender?
So you think there should be mandatory anger management classes for a team that is inherently violent encourages that type of violence?
I think if you are Pat Coletta or Rafi Torres or any of these guys, Andy Sutton back in the day, any of these guys that just don't seem to get it, yeah, I think that'd be pretty good to have a little counseling going on personally.
That seems too invasive to me.
I don't think it's too invasive at all. I think it's acknowledging that there is an edge, and some players choose to cross it frequently, and we have to figure out why that is, and maybe that's what keeps them in this league.
What keeps them in the league are general managers that feel they have value. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's what keeps them in the league. That's why I go back to your point about Darcy Regier. Darcy Regier isn't the only general manager to hire John Scott. There was a GM in Minnesota. There's a GM in Chicago. There are plenty of general managers that have hired Rafi Torres as well. There's a couple of general managers that have hired Matt Cook as well. As long as the general manager sees value in that player will stay in the league, regardless of how many suspensions they get, regardless of how many months worth of therapy sessions they go to. If that general manager thinks that this player, as wild as he may be, can help his team, he will have a job.
Tom Pauly writes in, guys, the hit was garbage, absolute garbage, but it's not the player that needs to be banned from the game. It's the hit. John Scott shouldn't be banned from the game for life because of a headshot. John Scott shouldn't be in the lineup because he is a bad player. If we're banning players for life for headshots, then everyone who gets an elbowing penalty needs to go. I had a Twitter argument with Bruins guys last night, and as dumb as it was, and it was really, really dumb, I offended both Bruins and Sabres fans by showing that Ferentz did something similar to Grabowski last year and got just one game. Everyone, every single player is capable, and many have made bad hits over the course of their careers,
yes,
but they weren't punished properly. The problem here maybe is the coaching staffs and management that employ players to do that stuff repeatedly. The Sabres employ Pat Coletta. Pat Coletta has a history of trying to hurt opponents. Maybe when he does something dumb, Ron Ralston and Darcy Regier need to be held accountable. I agree with everything that Tom said right there, and especially the part about how every player, not every player, but the majority of players are going to get into trouble at some point with a play like this.
Yes, every team will have a player on it in the next couple of years. That goes to the exact same situation.
I've often said that we've become a culture, a hockey culture, that's become summarily obsessed with supplemental discipline. If you listen to this program daily basis, we're as affected by it as anybody. But, when did this start where, like, you look at a guy like John Scott, who is an intimidator, who, granted, does not play, get a lot of ice time, isn't necessarily the most skilled guy in the world, right? Mm-hmm. But why – where did it become – like, where did the demonization of this guy come from last night? Like, I don't understand. Like, was because he chased Phil Kessel around the ice? Like,
he scared Phil Kessel? I know.
I mean, for God's sakes, man. Like, it was – the people talking about this guy last night, it was like they were talking about Chris Simon.
Did anybody bother to mention that John Scott almost scored a goal last night?
He doesn't have any skills.
He almost scored a goal last night.
No, doesn't have any skills.
Okay. But no, by the standards of the NHL – no, John Scott, like, skill-wise, you want to compare him to, you want to compare him to, like, Pascal Dupuis. No, he doesn't have a position in this game. You kidding me? No, you want to compare him to, like, Justin Williams? No, of course not. but he fulfills a very specific role, which is allowed under the CBA, under the rules of the game. Last time I checked, Wish, fighting wasn't a suspendable offense, and that's what he's there for.
Stephen Blank writes in, to Merrick's supposed point, at what point do you factor in the reality that Scott plays 3 minutes per game?
You don't.
I think that should contribute to a penalty term. You can baseline a player's minutes played per game on a trailing X number of games against league minimum and classify them that way. Could further dimensionalize against tenure in the league. Obviously, rookie forwards who get fewer minutes because of their longevity. Bottom line is advanced stats could better bucket douchebags who can't play from douchebags who can sort of play. That's an interesting point, but I here's the problem with this. Hockey is inherently a caste system. We have lines of diminishing ice time from 1 to 4.
Yeah.
We've got defensive pairings of diminishing ice time and frequently skills from 1 to 3. Defenseman 1 throws an elbow on a star player. Defenseman 6 throws the exact same elbow at a star player. Like, why should there be a difference?
You remember the first year that Josh Bailey played in the NHL and he was getting like 4 minutes a night? If he threw that hit by this super stats definition, he should be out of the league. Like, you have rookies that are playing those few minutes as well. It's not just John Scott of the world.
There are certain aspects of this debate that make me insane, and the player comparison, the meritocracy of supplemental discipline makes me insane. The idea that we would even entertain for one moment an eye for an eye solution to this problem is maddening to me. It really is maddening to me.
Hey, by the way, new fancy stat that we came up with, mainly Ken Reed, who is maybe the funniest guy that we have here at Sportsnet. New fancy stat. PIDs. You know what PIDs are?
What's that?
Pucks in deep. How many times did the player get the pucks in deep? How many pucks in deep did he get 5-on-5? Pucks in deep 5-on-4? Yeah, not that good, but pucks in deep 5-on-5? He's excellent. PID numbers. Wish.
PID numbers.
PID numbers. Yeah, your PIDs. What's your PID? Can you get a PID on an icing play when you're killing a penalty? The answer?
Pucks in,
no.
Pucks in deep.
That is not a PID. Pucks in deep.
His CNC, his chip and chase.
CNC, yeah. What's a CNC number like? Oh, he's got a good CNC, but only at home.
Oh, yeah.
On the road,
yeah.
5-on-5, not a good CNC.
Trevor Crowell writes in, the 10-game suspension, the 10-game automatic suspension for leaving the bench for a fight essentially ended the line brawls in the 1970s. So why are these headshots so hard to outlaw?
Because it is a play that will... You know why headshots exist? Because hitting isn't perfect. And I do think for one second that most of the headshot suspensions are from players that went out there deliberately to hit someone in the head, or were they just hits that, you know, were sloppy. Like, I have seen very few, in my estimation, deliberate shots to the head. I've seen a lot of high hits that bleed into the head, but I still don't believe
that
players
issue,
are
right?
deliberately going out there lunging themselves at players' heads.
Yeah, and that's the issue, right? Like, you only leave the bench one way. There are many, many different variations of headshots, right? So that's a pretty big difference between the two. A couple of things from Twitter here. Simon Mulholland, I agree consistency is needed, but that just tells me that the 5 games isn't enough, at least if you want to rid this.
Hang on. Remember when Colin Campbell would sit guys down for 20 or 25 games? You know what happened? Nothing.
Steve Downey changed his game a little bit.
Oh, after the 20 gamer?
Sure.
He was still wild.
The NHL should, this is from Greg Mondry, the NHL should suspend player and the coach, fine the team if repeat offender take away draft choices. What about suspending the coach?
No, I don't like that. What if you don't like your coach and it's the last game of the season? F this guy.
Jeremy Ballaston, John Scott should have to do the running man gauntlet. If he lives, he can play hockey again. I think he probably would, although I would be worried about Sub-Zero with the freeze ray. obviously a different kind of animal there. Hockeypedia, published standards. A blatant headshot is 10 games. Check from behind, 5 games. Intentional knee, 3 games. Second offense, double.
How do you prove what an intentional headshot is?
I know.
Show me the definition.
That's the problem with the mandatory minimums.
That's right.
In a perfect world, I'd love to have them, but it's almost impossible to make them consistent.
Yeah, you're dealing with a flow sport with players at different sizes, heights and weights, mm-hmm. all moving in concert with one another.
Jason Butler, name recognition shouldn't play into it. All things being equal, Scott should get no more games than Bergeron or Saint Louis, et cetera, et cetera. Agreed. Agreed.
And listen, our guest is standing by. So, again, I want to reiterate one point, then we'll pick up some of the tweets as well. Under the CBA, all, you know, the rights that John Scott should enjoy are the same rights that Sidney Crosby enjoys right now. Neither of them are repeat offenders in this situation. It may not sit well. May not sit well with you, but under the CBA right now, and this is what the NHLPA is doing, protecting the rights of the player. You look at Patrick Kleta and protecting the rights of John Scott as well.
Well, the Detroit Red Wings never needed a goon because they had this man between the pipes.
And they played Colorado.
Ready to rush out and throw them bows, throw them fists. He is Chris Osgood, and he joins us here on the Merrick vs. Wyshynski podcast. Hello, Chris. How are you?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Doing well, man. Hey, look, our question of the day for the listeners today is, if you could change one aspect, you know, make one change in the current supplemental discipline suspension system that the NHL has, what change would you make? What would you do to strengthen it up, Chris, and make these suspensions sting more?
They just have to have more mandatory games, I think, for certain instances. I mean, you see a lot of hitting from behind when they see the numbers for quite a long time. This year it's happened on more than one occasion, and you know, it happens a lot, and guys don't get hurt, but when they do get hurt, that's when you see suspension come. So maybe just if there's these hits and the guy's not injured, still there should be a minimum suspension and then obviously a maximum suspension. But just, I mean, more of a cut and dry system, I think. Not so much. It seems like five games is the fashionable thing right now. Yeah. But not after that hit last night. I think it could go way up.
But based on what? Because he's not a repeat offender. Like, shouldn't he have enjoy the same rights or be, you know, subject to the same punishment that, you know, Ryan Garbutt, who got five games, or Maxime Lapierre, who wasn't a repeat offender, but got five games as well? Like, I know
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I think in that instance, why should it matter? I mean, it was a pretty violent hit. I mean, it's exactly what the league's trying to stop in more ways than one. And to me, it's it is what it is, and it was a violent hit, and it was to the head, so it should be quite a bit.
How has hitting changed? I mean, you broke in the 90s. Has it changed?
I remember Scott Stevens and a lot of guys. Guy could pass the puck, and it would be 4 or 5 seconds later, and they'd crush him. I remember Kariya getting hit in the playoffs the one year.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Coming back and scoring. But you know, there was hard hits, but I just think there was more respect amongst the players. It wasn't as many headshots. Obviously, the submarine by some guys when they go down low and take out guys' knees, that had to end, and it did. But it just seems like there's a lot more headshots now than there ever has been. You know, but the players are bigger and they're quicker, and I mean that has a lot to do with it. But it just seems like there's not the same amount of respect and you want to say the rules within the rules that are followed by the players like there used to be.
Yeah, yeah. Moving over to the Red Wings, as we actually begin the hockey talk on this show and stop talking about suspensions, which is refreshing. What surprised you so far about Detroit? We're talking about a 6-4-1 team, 13 points over in the New Atlantic Division. What surprised you so far about the Red Wings?
Just their lack of secondary scoring, I think. I thought they were going to be able to score a lot more goals. Obviously, they picked up Alperson, and then they picked up Weist, who's kind of in the mud right now, learning how to play. He came from Florida, obviously different system, but completely different division than where he is now. And he's still learning the system, and he seems to be caught in the mud right now. But just, I think they've scored 22, 23 goals, and Datsyuk and Zetterberg have 50% of those. I mean, so that's not a good statistic to have moving forward into the season. You can't rely on just two guys for the entire year. And it seems like when those two are shut out or aren't the main guys, they lose. And you can't have that. I mean, they lost 1-0 to San Jose at home, and they couldn't figure out who was going to chip in one more goal, or they could have won that game. And they need that secondary scoring from their third and fourth line for sure. If they don't get that, they're going to be in some trouble this year.
From a goaltending point of view, curious about their goaltending coach, Jim Bedard, working with Gustafson, yeah, working with Jim Howard. Tell us a little bit about, because, of course, you're right there and know Jim Bedard well. Is he the type of goaltending coach that has a very specific style that he wants his goaltenders to play, or does he look at the goaltender and say, okay, that's the goaltender we have. How can I tweak what he already knows and what he already does?
Well, Jim's main thing is you got to be a goalie first. you block when you have to, and he likes his goalies to be out of the blue paint and aggressive on, especially when the guys have the puck at the point. He wants you to be out. And if you watch Jimmy Howard, he's always pushing out where vice versa. You watch Mike Smith, he sits back on his goal line when his pass is out front. He doesn't really come out and attack the puck like they do here. And, you know, I think Gustafson's played real well this year. It took him all last year. I know he was hurt and it was a shortened season. He was changing his style all last year, and even coming into this year in training camp from the way he played his last couple of years in Toronto. When he first came here, don't forget he was an athletic goalie. He was long legs, long arms, and he relied on his reflexes. And then he got turned into kind of a blocker with the goalie coach in Toronto, and it messed him up for a couple of years. And now he's kind of getting back to who he was when he first came over here. And I think you saw a little bit of that. I think a lot of some goalies, the equipment change has hurt. Other ones has helped. It's helped Gustafson. He moves a lot better, and he's getting that athleticism back in his game, where he's moving, catching pucks, not diving around, but making great saves. He made 18, 19 great saves in Colorado and enabled them to win that game. So I think he's on his way getting back to his nickname, the Monster, that he had when he first got over here.
Meanwhile, Jimmy Howard, who you've obviously worked with a lot during your career and during his career, 3-4-1 right now with a 260 goals against and a 914 save percentage. Talk a bit about his game this year, and do you think the fact that he is coming into this year knowing he needs to play lights out for the Olympics, do you think that's played on his mind at all?
I think he thinks about it for sure. I mean, he talks about it. He wants to be on the team 100%. He knows that he's auditioning to try and make that team, and it means a lot to him. I mean, he'd love to be there, and that's one of the things. I think there's also more pressure on him because the defense is young here. I mean, really young. I mean, besides Cronwall and Erickson, after that, it's really young with not a lot of experience, and there's a lot of nights where he's relied upon to be really, really good, and he has been. The thing with him is he plays the same way every game. I mean, he was playing the same way last night against Ottawa. They just happened to score on him, and obviously he's the type of guy that he thinks he's one of the best in the league and thinks he should have had him. And there were C&I goals and very good shots, a combination of that. But Ottawa really got guys in front of him and created their chances and took advantage of them.
Being joined by Chris Osgood, one of the only players in the history of the NHL to actually take a Shea Weber slap shot to the head and live to tell the tale. I want to go back to your career, Chris. Was that the worst you ever got in your head?
Oh, for sure, right in the jaw. Hit me. It was like 4-1 with less than a minute left in the game, so it was completely unnecessary. I think at that point I might have been 36, 37, so that makes it even more unnecessary. But that one stung. For one, I didn't see it, so I couldn't get ready for it. And two, obviously, it was Shea Weber. It was one of the hardest shots in the league. But like we talk about the rules within the rules, there's no reason to be shooting high heat late in a game like that, is there? Especially like when you're losing 4-1.
Mm-hmm. No.
Good point.
Especially ones that take off your skull cap.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We really enjoyed your interview, by the way, with Patrick Waugh. That was a really good time. We liked the saltiness of the chatter. But Merrick and I couldn't help but wonder, after the thing was done, lights turned off, microphones off, what the hell did you guys talk about then?
Before we talked a lot prior to it, just kind of hung out and talked about hockey and talked about the rival and about him coaching now, what it was like. He was talking about some of his players. And afterwards, he had to leave right away because he had to go watch Detroit practice in their pregame state, obviously. So I didn't talk to him a lot after. But he's relaxed. He's funny. I mean, I enjoyed talking to him. That was the first time I've talked to him ever, in fact, and the first time I've ever been in the same room as him since we fought 15 years ago, obviously.
Are you surprised a man that crazy could be a National Hockey League coach?
He definitely has some intensity to him, but I think he's different from when he was a player to when he's coach. Obviously, he coached in the Quebec Major Junior League, I think, 7 years. So I think he's learned how to coach, and he's a different person now. He's not that goalie, that intense. I don't want to say because he wants to win at all costs still, but just that. But how can I say that when 2 games in, he's fighting Bruce Boudreaux to the glass. I'm contradicting myself. So yeah, he still does it, and I'll be interested to see what happens when, I mean, they're riding the wave right now, but what happens when they eventually are going to lose some games here at some point? I mean, then what's going to happen? That would be interesting.
Yeah, we're all waiting to see how Patrick reacts to the first big losing skid. You know, there's a dynamic going on in New Jersey right now, Chris, that you can probably relate to, where Corey Schneider is transitioning now as the number one goaltender for the Devils. Martin Brodeur, the Hall of Fame certainly awaits. We're not sure how long he's going to play in the NHL. But, you know, you were that guy once upon a time taking that spot from Mike Vernon. Take us into the mind of Corey Schneider now as he takes over from Martin Brodeur, much like the way you took over from Mike Vernon. What was that like for you?
I think he's just playing. I think he knows that it's his time. I mean, he played well in Vancouver, not so well in the playoffs. He would have liked to have played better. But at his stage of his career, that doesn't matter. He's a good goalie going forward and has a great future. To me, one of the best young goalies in the league. For him, it's great. He has Marty Brodeur with him to teach him, to lean on. He's not by himself. You know, he has that Hall of Fame guy sitting with him while he's going through it. So if he does falter, Marty Brodeur is right there. So he's not going to feel that pressure. He's like he's alone on an island. He's going to be really good this year. I don't know how good their team is. I don't know if they're good enough to make it. But for me, he's probably the best young goalie in the league right now at his age. And moving forward, New Jersey's going to have a good goalie for a long time. And to have him with Marty Brodeur for maybe Marty's last year can only add to how good he's going to get moving forward. Now they're going to build a relationship this year playing together. Marty's not going to go anywhere. He's still going to be in the organization. So he'll be able to lean on him even when he's retired. So he's always going to have Marty Brodeur with him when he moves forward. And eventually New Jersey is going to be good, and he's going to play in some big games, and he's going to have an opportunity to have Marty Brodeur with him there the whole time. So that's nothing but a bonus for him.
Is there a goalie in this this next wave, you know, the wave behind Marty, and the wave behind Luongo, let's say, 18 to 27. Is there anybody in that group of goaltenders you really like to watch that you make time to watch?
Yeah, I like Carey Price. I think, like, his time is coming. I remember watching him when I was still playing. When he was younger. I'm like, wow, this guy is calm. He's really good. And we had really good teams, and we had 5-on-3s, and he played a great game in Joe Louis. He played great against us in Montreal. I just think it's just a matter of time for him until he becomes a star goalie that he's going to start in the playoffs one year here soon. Montreal is a good team. They're getting better, but he is – the least of their problems every year. I know they always talk about him in Montreal, but he's one of those guys that I see goalies that don't like pressure, and he plays in one of the most pressure-packed cities in the world and plays well doing it. And he has the talent. He's calm. He's calm and influence on his team. For me, it's just he's just ready to break out, and I think it's going to happen at any time here.
You know, we know, and this is the last one for me, Chris, and we thank you for your time. We all know about, you know, the headline defenseman that you got chances to play with the Detroit Red Wings, specifically Nick Lidstrom. But who are some of the defensemen that, you know, you as a goaltender would look at and say, you know what, this guy didn't get enough respect. No one really talked about this guy as much as they should have. You know, a lot of goaltenders say, you know what, Charlie Huddy was sneaky good. We loved playing when Charlie Huddy was on defense. Who are one or two of those guys for you?
The number one guy that comes to my mind is Brad Stewart. He just quietly plays his game the same way every game. He's better offensively than people think he is. He makes great first passes, and he's hard to play against in front of the net. And obviously it's hard, but he's a guy that he's a goalie's dream. Every game he plays the exact same way, no matter what night, where it is, and he's always reliable. And I think another guy for me, only because Lindstrom was here, was Rafalski was great. I mean, Rafalski's passing was unbelievable. Playing with him, I would always say, this guy's like Peyton Manning back there. He can be getting hit and still find a way to put a puck on somebody's tape somewhere down the ice. And he was, when we won in 2008, he was one of the main reasons because Ken Holland went out and got him, why we won. Nick didn't have to do it all by himself, and the opportunity to play with Lindstrom and Rafalski on the point of power play, to me, it doesn't get much better than that.
Finally, one for me, and I always promised myself, Chris Osgood, that I would ask you this if we got you on the show.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet lovely actress Kristen Bell, who said that you were her first
Never.
Crush?
I was. You know what? I was. This is. That's funny you said, because you know what we were talking about the other day of old stories, because Matthew Snyder, he messed this up. She was in L.A. and I was playing, and I was supposed to meet her after the game, and we were having a meal at the rink there before we left to go to Anaheim on the bus. And he told me that she was to the left but I went to the left, and so the way it happened is obviously she wasn't to the left, she was to the right. So I was standing there waiting. Not only did I not meet her, I missed the meal after the game and was late to the bus to go to Anaheim. So now I'm disappointed that I missed her. Now I'm mad at Snyder and Mike Babcock's mad at me. So it was a triple. It was a complete mess. But obviously, the number one thing is I didn't get to meet her. So that was. I never have. But that's the story of what
this
happened.
Sucks.
It was close, but not close.
If I had known that, I would have kicked in money to fund that Veronica Mars movie she's doing, contingent on her meeting you at some point. Like I can't believe that never happened. Merrick, he was her first crush.
Oh, I know.
Her first crush. Yeah,
loved the Chris Osgood.
Yeah, it was probably my biggest miss. My career could have been. I've let in some bad ones, but that could have been the one.
That's awesome.
All right, Chris Osgood. Thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast, man, and we'll hopefully hook up with you again down the road.
Thanks, Chris.
All right. Thanks,
Chris Osgood.
Interesting. You know, I mentioned that time with Mike. That was such a strange time for Detroit goaltenders because Vernon was the number one guy, and then I want to say it's 96, 97, Osgood comes in and takes the spot. Scotty Bowman gives him the spot, but in the playoffs, he goes back to Mike Vernon. He was one of the weirdest netminding dynamics that I had seen up until that point.
Valtteri Fupula,
yes,
4 goals, 2 assists, 8 games. Steven Weiss, as Chris Osgood mentioned, 2 goals, no assists, 11 games, -4. Terrible so far.
Yeah, not so good. They were playing him with Alfredson and Mule. So I remember hearing an interview with
Ken. They dropped him after that.
Yeah, I know. But I remember I heard an interview with Ken Holland. I think it was on 590 a couple of weeks into the season. They asked him, how's Weiss doing? He said, well, and when your GM says this, you know the trouble. Well, you know, he's having a tough time adjusting to Mike Babcock's system. Whenever you hear GM say, tough time adjusting to the system, he's not playing well. And, you know, plus we have, you know, a line of, you know, 3 guys that all come from different places. So it's going to be a little bit of a maturing process there. Yeah. Hasn't worked out great. Adjusting to the system.
One thing we didn't get into with Osgood, we talked about before the show, was the lack of small goalies.
Oh, should have asked him. Yeah, was
the
he the
small
last
goalie trend?
Was he last of the last of the small goaltenders? And
every
position. And oh man, did you see Chris Breen finally make his NHL debut for the Calgary Flames? Yeah, you see from Uxbridge. Yo, neighboring Stouffville. Chris Breen from Uxbridge makes his NHL debut as a 6'7" winger.
Wow.
Former Junior C hockey player. Junior C hockey player. That's where
Chris Terreri's.
Yeah, you know the small goalie is done. Sorry, Jonas Enroth. But it can't become more apparent right now.
You know, I'm looking up goalies here, and guys who I thought were small weren't.
Like who?
Jason Muzzotti was 6'1".
Hmm.
Joey McDonald is 6 foot. That was smaller than that. But none of them are
small.
Like man mountains.
6 foot. None I mean, them. 6 foot is kind of small by today's standards when you think about it. Everyone's got giants back there. But I mean, when you look at the style and you look at the nature of, you know, not making saves, but rather just blocking and playing percentages, it kind of does make sense. Because all you're trying to do is just take away shooting visibility. You're not worried about being athletic or, I don't know, having the nerve to make a save. Who would want that?
Morgan Rielly is sticking with the Leafs.
So is Olli Maatta with Pittsburgh. The big question is for how long? Because you can keep him up until 40 games. But after 40, mm-hmm. then they get, you know, that 1 year closer to unrestricted free agent status. You send him back before 40 and you can still, you know, even though the first year of the contract does kick in technically, it does keep them away from free agency if they go back by 40. So 9 is one threshold, 40 is another. But I've got
no problem with either of those, do you?
Staying? No, yeah. Not at all. And I guess right. I guess the conundrum in Pittsburgh is, does he take Robert Bortuzzo's spot? Or they just flip-flop? I'll tell you, you know who's getting stung right now? Not to get all junior hockey on you, but the London Knights. Because they lose Olli Maatta, and they might lose Nikita Zadorov. By the way, he scored a goal last night. Congratulations, first NHL goal. That was a big piece of London Knights defense. But I got no problem with Morgan Rielly sticking. He's one of the Maple Leafs' best defensemen. He can pass and skate the puck out of trouble. First guy back when he gets caught up front. Sean Monahan stays with. You talked about that yesterday, I bet, right?
Yeah, I talked about that. What did you think of that?
He made the team, and so he should stay. Calgary is selling hope, and that is them, you know, displaying hope for 41 home dates for their fans. But suspecting what type of year it's going to be for the Calgary Flames, I don't know that he's better served just going back to junior for one more year. Like, you think of Sam Gagne, and retrospectively, even though he made the Oilers in year one, do you think he should have gone back to the OHL for one more year? Like, players have never been hurt by that extra year.
Someone took you to task for that. I forget. I got to find the email.
Okay, find me the guy. And don't say Joe Cirella, because he played the one year in the NHL. Don't tell me Joe Cirella.
It was someone else that brought it up. I saw it on email the other day, and I forgot to.
So there's one example? Okay. But really, give me the example of a guy that's been hurt by going back. You said, you know what? He would have been a great pro player, but they kept him in junior that extra one year.
Brendan Moore writes in, the difference between Doan, Keith, or Brown is the base level of annoyance with them is much lower. It's like if a person who you like at work borrows something off your desk, it's okay. However, if that asshole who microwaves fish for lunch borrows something...
I know that guy!
Then let Zeus rain down terror on their soul. Reformed random penguin Matt Cook. Again, I agree. Like, and I think it's a good point because I think at the end of the day...
The skill set
thing is a code word for we find these players more palatable than Pat Coletta or John Scott based on their roles.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
But, you know, they're saying.
But listen, Dustin Brown can be a pretty annoying hockey player.
So can Shane Doan.
Yep.
They're in that sort of purgatory between like star players and the goonish dregs of the league.
Matty brings up a good point in my ears as well. What about Corey Perry? There's another one. Like, in a lot of ways, if you're a fan that wants to see the superstars of the league, who may walk the line themselves occasionally, if you want to see them stay in the game, you don't want a 20-game suspension for John Scott. Because then, he does not have a history. He has not been called on the carpet by the Department of Player Safety. You're protecting Shane Doan, and as crazy as it sounds, you're protecting, you know, Shane Doan and Jerome McGinley and Dustin Brown, these kind of guys.
And again, like, I'm sorry that we piss off people and have people thinking that we're holier than thou and sometimes Neanderthalic in our thinking. But honestly, like, can you just, if you believe that John Scott is a repeat offender, find me the suspension or tell me what happened with Kessel, how that possibly plays into player safety. I heard, not to throw anybody under the bus here, but like I was listening to XM on the way back from New York today, and they were literally, Peter Burris is saying that John Scott's a repeat offender.
Based on what?
Based on Kessel.
He didn't get suspended for that.
But there was more than one. Keith Jones brought up Kessel. Like, what happened in that situation that
John
somehow...
John Scott was the only guy that didn't get his hand slapped. Because you look at the rule book and you say, there's nothing here for that type of behavior.
Yeah, like, how does repeat offender not automatically go to Ron Ralston in that situation and not John Scott? I just don't get it, man. Like, and again, it's one of those times where you come off sounding like a complete asshole because it makes so much sense to you, yet others don't see it the same way, that it makes you bang your head against the desk. And that's why I hate Twitter.
You can't resist it. See, I read it a lot last night, but you know, I said, you know what? I don't want to get myself involved in this. I don't have the time. I just want to watch hockey last night. I don't want to spend it fighting on Twitter. You can't resist. You can't. You see the cheese. You see the trap. You still try to take the cheese. That's you, Greg.
It's good times. All right, everybody.
It's good times. It's good cheese, man. Come on.
Thanks for joining us today. By the way, 31 goals in 30 games for Alex Ovechkin. That's a pretty good run, huh?
Yeah, not too shabby. Not too shabby.
Remember when we were questioning whether or not he was still an elite player?
Still an elite goal scorer. How about that?
Oh, so you don't see him as an elite player?
I see him as an elite goal scorer. Isn't that how you see Ovechkin?
Interesting. I think he's always been a better player than people gave him credit for. But I mean, what's Steven Stamkos then?
Oh, he's a more complete player than Alexander Ovechkin, dude. Oh, yeah. And so is Pavel Datsyuk.
Was Danny Heatley a complete player?
No.
So
no, sir.
Alex Ovechkin akin to Danny Heatley.
No, because Alexander Ovechkin cares more.
Mm-hmm.
Alexander Ovechkin hustles more.
Mm-hmm.
Alexander Ovechkin is more engaged in the game than Danny Heatley.
And probably would accept a trade to Edmonton.
I wouldn't go that far.
I don't think so. I don't know about that. We didn't talk about that actually the other day. The end of the grievance between Heatley and the Ottawa Senators.
Do we know we don't know any of the specifics of it, though, do
we? Sir, the ruling has been sealed. We do not know anything about the settlement between the Ottawa Senators.
All that takes is one good primetime sports interview with Eugene Melnyk to have it all out there. Because Eugene gets on PTS and that's it. He just starts spilling.
I'm still trying to figure out how there was even a grievance. Like, what beef could the Senators have?
I know.
They're the one who gave him the contract.
I know. Dude, I know. I agree. Like, you know what? I bet the soft point was like, all right, let's just make this go away. Our client will take 80% of it. I don't know what the ruling was, though.
I just hope that Danny Heatley has some dough saved up because, you know, once he's out of the Wild system and earning Jonathan Chichu money while Thomas Vanek takes his spot.
Dude, he would have been bought out last year if he wasn't injured. It's the worst kept secret in the NHL.
I thought that was that Thomas Vanek's going to the Wild.
That too. Everybody from Minnesota's a big magnet for people that had any association with Minnesota.
By the way, question of the day tomorrow. Just make sure that you could get him in already. Question of the day tomorrow, I've just decided.
What?
Along with Game Show Friday, question of the day is, what's the worst kept secret in the National Hockey League?
Okay, that's good.
It's a good one, right?
PuckToDayBlog
at yahoo.com, @WishinSki, @JeffMerrick on Twitter, #MVSW. Worst kept secret in hockey is. Oh, and by the way, notice that we've gone about 7 minutes over. I'm back in Alexandria, Virginia, and not in someone else's conference room. So
no,
that's why
knocking
we're
on the door?
Finish the show today. No, I'm knocking at the door. Dude, the daggers that I got from those people that would open the door and see me, like, not only with all the podcasting stuff all spread out, but, like, with a bowl of kimchi rice and, like, two Red Bulls. I mean, it really is like someone dropped a blogger bomb in that room and, like, all of a sudden it just becomes, like, my office. It's terrible.
Didn't have, like, discarded Taco Bell wrappers all over the place?
And then I go, like, to find the people that wanted to use the room, like, and I'm just like, hey, you know, I'm done. And then, like, they'll be at some tiny little table in the cafe area. And they'll be like, we're fine, thanks. It's like, I'm sorry. Like, sorry you couldn't talk to your client and make the company money. I had to do a podcast.
Are you saying that the Yahoo people are bad people?
I'm not saying that they're bad people. I'm saying that they're extraordinarily inconsiderate people.
Oh, they're insufferable people.
No, okay. It's as someone pointed out on Twitter the other day, like, it's my fault for not making sure the room was booked beyond an hour, but I don't have what's called foresight sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, you weren't circumcised?
I don't have foresight.
Right. I wasn't sure. We're going to the turtleneck talk there.
No, if I was circumcised, I wouldn't have foresight. Right. And in fact, I am circumcised, so I have no foresight.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's podcast. Talking
L'chaim. All right, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.